Of all the wonders that I yet have heard, it seems to me most strange that men should fear, seeing that death, the necessary end, will come when it will come.
This week on Historics is the third part series of the Julius Caesar saga. His continuous rise to power, his alliance with Pompey and Crassus, that is the first triumvirate, and still everything in between. Hello and welcome back to the Historics with CC. I am your host, Chioma Okorafor. This is a podcast where we bring you true, interesting, historical and factual stories that happened way back in the past. Some of these stories are well known and very popular, while some might be totally new to you. That means you don't know them and you really should get to know them. Our history lesson today continues with the life of Julius Caesar. We started by looking at Julius Caesar's early years, his appointment as a priest, his marriage to Cornelia, his refusal to divorce her, because of which he had to leave Rome for a while, his face-off with the Roman dictator then, General Sulla, his mother's intervention in the situation, enabling him to return back to Rome, his winning of the civic crown in battle, being captured by pirates for a while, his being ransomed, recapturing the pirates, and executing them. We also talked about his having a daughter called Julia with his wife, losing his wife and aunt to the cold hands of death, later remarrying Pompeia, the granddaughter of Sulla in 67 BC, and finally becoming Quaestor in 68 BC. And this is where we pick up from today. Now, just before Julius Caesar got elected as Quaestor, he was elected into another priesthood office. That is the office of a pontifex in 73 BC. A pontifex is a member of the most distinguished college of priests in the Roman religion. So, as at that time, Julius Caesar was not just a public official, he also held a religious office. Now, the good thing about being a pontifex then was that the office wasn't as restrictive as the Flamen Dialis, where you had to be at a particular place, he had to do some certain things as a priest. No, with this religious office, he could do whatever he wanted, eat what he wanted, attend funerals if he wanted to, travel out of Rome whenever he desired, and most especially, it wouldn't be like a hindrance to him handling the public office. Rather, it would even be a plus, because as I said earlier, the Romans are very religious people. So somebody who is already holding a religious office, running for public office, you're more like endearing yourself to them. So him becoming a pontifex was actually going to help his career later on as we continue. Within the same time he was elected as a pontifex, he was also elected as a military tribune. He was serving as a military officer at a lower level, in addition to be a pontifex. Now the question would be, how was Julius Caesar juggling all these offices together? Well, it really wasn't that much of a big deal, because in Rome as at then, the military and religious duties didn't exactly have a clear-cut difference like you are a soldier and you are a pastor or you are a priest, no? Everything was kind of intertwined. A person could easily become a priest and at the same time still hold an office in the military, as is the case of Julius Caesar now. So, at this point in Julius Caesar's life, he is a military tribune. This position is actually at the bottom rung of the ladder when it comes to public offices, but glass half full. It was also the first stepping stone when it came to the same public offices. Now, the next step in the public office after the military tribune is the office of the quaestor. And that is where we're going to start today's history lesson from. So, after Julius Caesar became elected as pontifex and military tribune, he also ran for the office of quaestor and he got elected. Julius Caesar was not slowing down, like he was just ready to take everything, not one step at a time, he was going 100 miles a minute. In the last episode, we got to know that one of the jobs of the quaestor is being in charge of public funds and government revenues. Well, the other quirks of being a quaestor was that the quaestor got to be like an assistant or an advisor to the governor of one of Rome's provinces. So as quaestor, Julius Caesar got assigned to the governor of Spain as an advisor, and he immediately set sail for Spain to carry out his official duties. Now, his main task in Spain when he arrived was to perform a financial audit in his capacity as quaestor, which he effectively carried out. I think at this point you know that Julius Caesar is a man who, once he has a plan, he goes straight for it and he executes it perfectly. Now, while he was in Spain, he visited a temple where there was a statue of Alexander the Great. While he was observing the statue and probably pondering on Alexander's life, his defeats and his battles and his death, Caesar got to realize that he was around the same age Alexander had been when he literally conquered the world and died not long after. With this realization, Caesar suddenly felt that he had barely gotten anything done. He felt very upset with his life. When he thought back on everything he had done so far, in which I'm even kind of saying he had done much, he felt that he had done nothing in comparison to Alexander, because they were about the same age. Caesar must have been in his early 30s then. Alexander at that point had already conquered the world. Alexander died at the age of 33, and Caesar felt he had barely gotten anything done, like he had barely scratched the surface. And with that, Caesar determined at that point in time, in that very temple, that he was going to make a name for himself. The question is, did he do that? Did he actually make a name for himself? Did he actually carve his initials in the sands of time? Answer, yes. I mean, we are talking about him today, aren't we? So he actually did carve a name for himself, which you got to remember, thousands of years later. So in 65 BC, Julius Caesar returned to Rome, and within a short time, he got elected to the next higher position from the quaestor, which is a position of the aedile. Now, the aedile was a very prestigious office in Rome, okay? Whoever had the office of the aedile got to organize basic services in Rome. But most especially, the reason why a lot of people wanted the position of the aedile was because every year, the aedile was in charge of throwing very big festivals. And just like basic human nature, every year, the current aedile wants to outshine the other aedile, so people would remember him more when he wanted to run for public office. And that was one of the main reasons why a lot of people were clamoring for this position. But Julius Caesar got elected as the aedile, and at this point he has a game to plan. They call it game there, but it's like he has an event to plan for the aedile festival. Now, although Rome had a public budget for this kind of activities, naturally the government always has a public budget for activities that has to do with the public, but more often than not, whoever the aedile was at that point in time would always want to exceed the budget and use his own money, even if it means borrowing, to make sure his own aedile or event or festival, if you will, is bigger than the previous aedile's festival. And Julius Caesar was no exception. Julius Caesar's aedile was like one of the best aediles ever. He outshone himself. I mean, anything to get the applause of the people, and Caesar was no exception. I believe his primary aim was to outshine all the other aediles of the past, and he most likely did. Because during the celebration, there were about 300 gladiators, all decked out in shiny armors, a huge feast of games, public displays that were really extravagant and looked really expensive. I just can only imagine how beautiful and how magnificent they must all have looked. However, the downside of this power display was that Caesar had run into a huge debt of about 30 million sesterti. A sesterti is like a type of currency used by the Romans. It's a small silver coin. Just like we have the American dollars and pennies, we have the Nigerian naira, we have the European pounds, yeah, just like that. Now, of course, Julius Caesar couldn't have funded this whole show from his pocket, because a member of the higher social class, which Julius Caesar was, mostly earned at most about 400,000 sesterti. But Julius Caesar had incurred a debt of 30 million sesterti. Just try to do the math. Calculate 400,000 multiplied by I don't know how many sesterties, but I'm sure that's a huge amount of money. So as at this point, our dear Julius Caesar has incurred a debt of 30 million sesterti. Now, since the public budget for such events obviously won't cover such amounts of expenditure Caesar made, how did he get the money? The simple answer is this: loan. He took loans from the rich merchants in town. He took a loan from Crassus. Crassus, like one of the richest people in town. We're going to talk about him in the next part of this episode. He's one of the people that formed the first triumvirate with Caesar and Pompey. Now, back to Caesar. So he took a loan from Crassus, loans from a lot of people, in order to get the level of public attention he wanted for himself. And did he get the attention? Yes, sirree, he actually did, and it was going to show in his next step of power. Now, another question is this: why would Julius Caesar even attempt such a daring risk just to show a display of power and wealth? I mean, right now his income is not that high, like 400,000 sesterti divided by how much he has to pay for 30 million sesterti. That's a lot. There's a huge gap in between. And he's not actually a high-ranking official now. So what was the big idea? Another simple answer. You see, this man, Julius Caesar, knew about the famous slogan, I'm very sure. You have to spend money to make money. He knew that if he continued buying the hearts of people with such lavish displays, and of course with his intelligence, I mean, the man was a very intelligent man, he would achieve four things. One, he would be able to climb to the tippy top of the political ladder. Two, he would amass a lot of wealth when he has climbed it. Three, he would become extremely wealthy. Four, he will finally pay off his debts. Sounds like a plan, right? That was the kind of person Julius Caesar was, like a daredevil kind of person. He saw risk and he took risk. I think he also knew the slogan, no risk, no reward. Moving on. In 63 BC, Caesar became elected as a praetor. Now, there are usually 8 praetors and 2 consuls in Rome. The 2 co-consuls were elected as a means to check balance each person's power, so we don't have one person having excessive power. Now remember, the position of a praetor was a step lower than that of a consul. So you see, Caesar was gradually moving up the ladder. No, not even gradually. Caesar was really moving up the ladder, and at this rate, he would soon become a consul. A consul is one of the highest positions in the Roman Republic as at then, and Caesar had this ambition to be a consul. You know, he had this desire, he had this passion, this drive to not just be a consul. He wanted to be in the 1% of the 1% of Rome, and that had always been his sole purpose. Like, he had this clarity of purpose, he knew what he wanted, and he would do anything to get it. So illustrate this point, there was a brief incident that occurred, and this showed just how determined Caesar was to be the number one man in Rome. One time when Caesar and his men were returning from Spain, they passed by a local village, a quote-unquote backward village. Now, why they were passing, Caesar's friends asked him if he thought there was going to be any kind of political struggles or wars or any form of uprising or rebellion in such a village, and they just laughed about it. Caesar didn't join in the fun. Instead, Caesar said, in his words, he would rather be the first man to conquer that village than to be the second man in Rome. This goes to show how very passionate about his goal Caesar was. Caesar didn't let anything stop him. In order for us to get really far in life, we have to have this kind of laser focus. Yes, of course, there will be distractions, there will be things to stop you from your goal, but if you have a clear-cut vision and a clear-cut goal about where you're going, these distractions can't stop you. And that was the kind of person Caesar was. He was determined to be the best of the best in Rome. And eventually, fate smiled on him and his ambition. Okay, so back to Caesar. In the same year he was made praetor, the election for the position of the Pontifex Maximus was held. The Pontifex Maximus is actually the chief priest of the whole of Roman Republic. It's actually a very big deal. At this point, Caesar was already a pontiff, and there are about 15 pontiffs in the College of Pontiffs, Caesar and 14 others. Now, usually, the post of the Pontifex Maximus had to be chosen by the other 14 pontiffs, as in 14 of the pontiffs would come together, nominate one of their own, and elect him as the Pontifex Maximus. That was the usual practice, but recently the rules had changed that it now involved the public, and the public would be able to vote for whoever would be the Pontifex Maximus instead of the other 14 pontiffs appointing one of their own to become the Pontifex Maximus. In a way, this was very good news for Caesar, because he had just thrown one of the biggest and the most lavish in our face, so it would naturally make people remember what he had done and vote him. The chances of him becoming Pontifex Maximus was very high. So armed with that thought, Caesar decided to run for the office. And he had 2 more experienced opponents, candidates, 2 other pontiffs that would naturally have won the position. But because Caesar had recently become more popular with the people, this made him win. And he became the Pontifex Maximus of Rome in 63 BC. Now, a point to note here, the office of the Pontifex Maximus It's pretty much like that of the Flamen Dialis, the other priesthood. It's not a yearly office, rather it's for a lifetime. So that means as at the time of Julius Caesar's death, he was still the Pontifex Maximus of Rome. So, now Julius Caesar had become the chief priest and he was given a house. Actually, the house came with a position. And so for the first time, Julius Caesar moved out of his home in Subura, where he grew up all his life, and moved into a beautiful new house in the best and the choicest part of Rome. And he started enjoying the perks of power. Another good thing about this position was that it really wasn't like a hands-on job where he had to be there full-time. Rather, it was more like a job where the bearer, the Pontifex Maximus, just held the office title, but there was really no binding work to be done. Unlike the Flamen Dialis, where there were lots of ancient and restrictive rules. So now we have Caesar having multiple positions at the time. He's a quaestor, he's a praetor, and right now he's a Pontifex Maximus of Rome. He is climbing up both the political and the religious ladder. Moving on in his career, Caesar carried out his functions in his office as praetor the next year and continued serving in Rome, adding some more job descriptions on top of the ones he had. He actually had a lot of successes while he was in Rome, and at the same time, he had a lot of scandals too to his name. Julius Caesar was known to have several mistresses, even while he was married. He didn't just have affairs with single ladies, he also had affairs with married women. One of them was Servilia. Now, praetors and consuls were usually sent to be governors in some of Rome's provinces after their 1 year in office. On the one hand, the consuls got to be governors of large cities like Italy and lived a good life, while on the other hand, the praetors got sent to smaller cities or larger villages where wars were less likely to break out. I make this point about wars because these leaders, they craved wars actually. You see, in the event of a war, even though there were casualties, the governors also got to keep the enemy loot and in so doing increase their financial reserve, especially if they had formidable soldiers, okay? So you see, sometimes the wars turned out to be in the favor of the governors. So yeah, that's that about that. Now after Caesar's praetorship, he was sent back to Spain as governor to govern for a year. But something funny happened while Caesar was leaving for Spain. He didn't leave the way he should have left. I mean, all pomp and pageantry, like, at this point, he was actually a Pontifex Maximus, so he was entitled to live in a big way, right? But no. You see, by this time, Caesar had incurred so much debt that he basically had to sneak out of Rome, otherwise he could be prosecuted and arrested for his debts. The thing was that, as a praetor, Caesar could not be prosecuted for his debts because as a law in Rome, and I'm sure in a lot of other countries presently, no public official could be prosecuted. And as a governor of Spain, he definitely couldn't be prosecuted either. However, there was a little gap, a little leeway, in which his creditors could take advantage of and sue him. Caesar knew this could happen, and that was why he escaped out of Rome in the cover of darkness. Now, when he came to Spain, Caesar once again proved himself to be the resourceful leader we have been seeing all through. He started cleaning up the city's mess, like, of course, not literally cleaning up the city. I mean, more like taking care of criminals and rebellious people who didn't want to submit to Roman rule in the country. You know, he basically took on the tasks that previous governors had avoided. Some people would just say, let well enough be. If they don't trouble us, let's leave them. They're not causing trouble, so let the rebels stay on their own. Let us stay on our own. But Caesar was not that kind of person. He jumped right into the action and got these rebels under subjection, getting rid of those who didn't want to comply. And as for the others, he accepted their surrender. And after he had forced the rebels to surrender, Caesar turned them into what they had actually hated and fought against. He made them become tax-paying citizens of Rome. And that is one of Caesar's strategies in battles, yeah? If you don't want to submit, he gets rid of you. But if you surrender, he lets you leave. And in so doing, he turns enemies into allies, or in this case, compulsory Roman citizens. So after a year in Spain with a lot of added achievement to his heart, his imaginary heart, Caesar returned to Rome. Remember, the governorship of the praetor only lasted for a year, so Caesar was done with his ruling in Spain and he returned to Rome. Now, on his return to Rome, Caesar had two objectives before he came back. One, he wanted to be elected as a consul. Remember, he was a praetor and the next step on the ladder politically would be a consul. And two, he wanted to celebrate a triumph. What is a triumph? A triumph in ancient Rome was basically the highest honor a Roman could achieve. It was usually bestowed on a victorious military commander who had not once, not twice, but consistently led his troops to victory. Now, this was the process of attaining a triumph. The soldiers of the military commander would have to nominate him for the triumph, and if they did, he could then apply in turn to the Senate, and if the Senate approved, the commander could then come into Rome and accept the triumph. The triumph is in form of a wreath of laurels placed on the head of the receiver, accompanied with a lot of huge festivals and fanfares to celebrate the event. It was actually a very big deal. So Caesar's men had already nominated him for the triumph, and the Senate were likely to approve giving it to him. It wasn't approved yet, but they were inclined to give it to him. Now, if Caesar received this triumph, it would be a really huge leap for him in his quest of becoming the number one man in Rome, or being at the top of the food chain. However, obtaining a triumph was rare, even for a war hero. See, at this time, there were about 500 to 600 senators, but only a handful of them had actually received a triumph. For any Roman politician, earning a triumph would be like the literal frosting on the cake, and it would greatly boost their military career. And here we have Caesar, who had already been nominated, and from all indications, he was most likely to receive the triumph. Caesar knew how important the triumph was to his political career. That is why he actually wanted to get it. So at this point, everything is looking good for Caesar. He had some victories in Spain, and he had won other wars too. His men had nominated him for the triumph. The Senate were most likely to approve it for him. But Caesar soon ran into a snag, like a problem occurred for Caesar. You see, at this time, after being a praetor for a year, Caesar naturally wanted to run for the next higher position, which was that of the consul. He had already started his process while he was in Spain. He had been writing a lot of letters to Rome, and he was a very good writer. He had been writing to state his cause and also to gather support when he does run for the position. So the consulship elections were slated to hold right after Caesar got back from Spain, and Caesar was back just at the right time. Now here was where Caesar met the problem. Caesar wanted both the triumph and the consulship at the same time. Now, in order for a person to receive the triumph, he had to be outside of Rome. He couldn't be in the city and celebrate the triumph. He had to be outside. Then he would be called in and the wreath of laurels would be placed on his head. But in order for him to run for consulship, he had to be physically present in Rome. And this was a big problem because Caesar could not be inside of Rome to run for the consulship elections and at the same time be outside of Rome waiting for the triumph. He had to be at one place at a time. So what was he supposed to do at this point? Was he going to give up the triumph and enter Rome to run for the consulship elections? Or was he going to forego the consulship and give up one of the highest honors in Rome? That's a very tough choice, right? Well, Caesar appealed to the Senate from outside of the city gates, and he asked them to let him stand for the consulship election in absentia. Like, he couldn't get into the gate because of the triumph, and he couldn't run for election from outside of the city gate. So he appealed to the Senate and asked them to let him stand for the election in absentia. Now, the Senate was almost inclined to grant his request, but one of the senators called Cato, who really hated Caesar, blocked the motion. He just literally talked and talked and talked for a long time until the Senate meeting came to an end. Therefore, they didn't have the time to vote Caesar's appeal. Hence, Caesar now really had to pick between celebrating his triumph or running for consulship. Now, when a messenger brought this news to Caesar that Cato had ruined his chance at being considered, Caesar didn't waste any time, or he didn't start thinking what next to do. He immediately walked through the city gates, and with this act, he effectively gave up on the triumph and ran for consulship. Now, who exactly was Cato? Let's find out what happens in the next episode of the Julius Caesar saga. I mean, this man has such an interesting life. We can't really exhaust it in 3 or 4 podcast episodes, but we will do our best to leave it at least 4 episodes. Okay, so join us same time next week on all our streaming platforms, on Spotify, on Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Boomplay, and a host of other streaming platforms. And you can also reach me on email at thehistoricswithcc@yahoo.com. Again, thehistoricswithcc@yahoo.com, and on Instagram at thehistoricswithcc. Until next Throwback Thursday, bye.